Health and Human Services Budget Division will come to order. We're going to continue reviewing the DHS portion of the governor's budget. And we're going to resume with Chuck Johnson. And I believe we left off in that section. Page.
Madam Chair, that's correct. Madam Chair, Chuck Johnson with the Department of Human Services, Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services. We left off on page 14 of the Children and Family Services section of the budget book. Madam Chair, page 14 is changes to the child support program, a couple of eliminations of small funds. The first small fund that we're proposing to eliminate is the medical provider bonus, which is $300,000 a year. This is a bonus that's paid to hospitals for the establishment of paternity using the recognition of parentage approach to establishing paternity. Paternity is very important to child support enforcement. This is a non-contested way of getting paternity established at the hospital at the time of a child's birth. This was put in place a number of years ago to help us increase our paternity establishment rate in Minnesota. We exceed the federal standard for paternity establishment for a number of years in a row now. We believe that we can continue to meet that standard without these dollars in place. The hospitals have now established this procedure, and we believe that we can move forward and continue to meet our paternity establishment goals without the bonus in place. The second piece on this page is $100,000 revenue to the general fund. In 2004, the University of Minnesota came forward with a proposal to create a healthy marriage and responsible fatherhood program. They were able to get money from the federal government through the Federal Office of Child Support Enforcement and sought state match, which was provided in the form of a $5 increase to the marriage license fee, which was then dedicated to this project in the form of $100,000 a year. That project has ended. The revenue is still dedicated and coming to the department. We're proposing to undedicate the revenue and have it flow to the general fund, which is a net benefit of $100,000 to the general fund.
And Assistant Commissioner, when you say the program has ended, what does that mean? I mean, does it mean that hospitals are no longer doing this, or somehow the project got hospitals to incorporate it into their regular activities, or what does it mean?
Madam Chair, the program that ended, I was referring to, is University of Minnesota's pilot around healthy marriage. The first piece of this, which you're referring to, is the paternity establishment recognition of parentage form. That is now an ongoing procedure that we have in place with hospitals for the recognition of parentage. Currently, we do pay them $25 for each recognition of parentage that we get from that hospital. It's actually, over the last couple of years, been a lesser amount because we've had to prorate because we haven't had enough money in the account to pay the full $25. We believe that we'll continue to get the same level of cooperation from hospitals and continue to establish paternity at the same level without having the $25 incentive in place.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? If not, let's move on then.
Madam Chair, the next page 15, deals with the Minnesota Food Assistance Program, MFAP. The Minnesota Food Assistance Program is a state-funded supplement, essentially, to the federal food stamp program, which is now called Supplemental Nutritional Assistance, or SNAP. This was started in 1998. You'll recall that in the mid-90s, the federal government removed some legal non-citizens from the food stamp program. Minnesota, a number of other states, created state programs to capture and provide food assistance to those individuals. In 2003, this was, in fact, was limited to only individuals over age 50, so it was limited further. It basically is a mirror of the federal food assistance, food stamp program. We follow the same rules and benefit levels and so forth. The program is run like an entitlement, but funded with a fixed appropriation of $408,000 a year Over the last year or so, we have seen two pressures on this program. One, in the federal stimulus for the food stamp program, they increased benefits by 13.6% for all eligible families and individuals. That was passed through to MFAP. We've also seen the caseload go up, consistent with the overall caseload in the SNAP program. In the case of MFAP, from about 200 to 250 people a month. We don't have enough money in this account to pay for the current need within the MFAP program. In 2010, we will be short that this current year. We're proposing, there was a some money that was lost in a rider, essentially, but it was in this same appropriation last year. We're going to use that money this year to cover the remainder of the fiscal year so that we can cover the entire fiscal year for MFAP. In 2011, however, we estimate that with the current $408,000 appropriation, we'd be $200,000 short of the estimated need in 2011. We're proposing then to eliminate the program if this recommendation is not taken and the committee desires to continue the MFAP program. It would require an additional $200,000 in 2011 to make the program whole.
Are there any questions about this page? Seeing none, let's move on then.
Madam Chair, the next page is page 16. This includes reduction of one grant and elimination of another. This page proposes to reduce by $1.3 million in 2011 dollars that were appropriated for supported work in the MFIP program. There have been several appropriations made for supported work in MFIP over the last couple of years. This supports a model of transitional employment, subsidized employment for individuals in MFIP is a benefit to our work participation rate to get people working. This would reduce that by $1.3 million. It proposes a one-time reduction. That's a mistake on the page. If you look at the tracking at the top, it shows the continuing into the base. Numbers for 12 and 13 should be $460,000 of savings in each year, not the larger number that's shown there. Based on the current spending that we're seeing in supported work, we think that with removing this $1.3 million, that we'll have as much available in 2011 as we have available in 2010, or as counties are likely to spend in 2010. It's a little difficult to estimate this because we're estimating county spending. We're also estimating what earnings we're going to get through the stimulus money. You'll recall that last year we also put in place earnings so that earnings we get through federal stimulus and TANF for supported work, for subsidized work, are dedicated back into increasing the number of subsidized work that we do. We've already earned $2.3 million through that door. We think we could earn as much as $8.5 million under the stimulus, which would also then add into the county's total dollars they have available for supported work. So, as I said, this is a proposed one-time reduction.
Madam Chair?
Senator Lurie?
Yes, if this is, what's the 460 in 12 and 13 then, if it's a one-time?
Madam Chair, Senator Lurie, that's the next piece I'm going to get to.
Okay.
There are two reductions on this page. I talked about the supported work,
okay,
which is 1.3.
Okay.
It's fine. The second one is a reduction of a grant in the GRH program of $460,000. This is a special grant that's above and beyond the normal supplementary rate and beyond, in fact, the enhanced rate that we pay for some services. This flows to a program called People Incorporated, which provides services to seriously mentally ill individuals. This is a special grant above and beyond the normal money provided to GRH providers. We're proposing to eliminate that grant as well.
Assistant Commissioner, if we are making a reduction in the supported work expenditures, will we lose stimulus dollars that we could be earning?
Madam Chair, it would depend on the timing. The stimulus only runs through September 30th of 2010. We're proposing to make this reduction in 2011, so there'd be a three-month overlap there, but I'm not sure that the $1.3 million would make a lot of difference to how much activity would happen in that three-month period. In theory, it could. But it depends in part, again, on how much counties are ramping up, which is a little hard to judge right now. This year, with money that was appropriated previously in 2010 and carry forward, there's about $12.6 million that's available to counties in supported work. Through half of the year, they spent about $3.4 million. And we expect they'll spend more than that in the second half of the year, and that's what counties are telling us. We're not sure how much more. Last year, they spent about $7.4 million. So it may be about that range or a little bit more. And I can give you, we can give you these numbers in writing so you can sort of see what the pattern looks like. But the other piece of it, as mentioned before, that's uncertain is how much we're earning, how much earnings we will get through the TANF stimulus, which could be as much as $8.5 million that would be added in. Again, all this money has carry forward on it as well beyond 2011, so it would be available into 2012 if it is still unspent.
If you could get us whatever you have on that, that would be good. I guess I'm also getting a little information here that there's a bill in Congress to extend that stimulus money out further into the future. So then if we cut this state appropriation, then maybe we wouldn't be eligible for that extended stimulus money.
Madam Chair, that would then impact probably our ability to earn if there was an extension of the TANF. Then taking the 1.3 out may have an impact on our ability to earn additional stimulus money.
Then just a comment in regard to the grant cut. You know, the program that People Incorporated has is not just not just your run-of-the-mill GRH program. It's a program that takes very, very long-term homeless, mentally ill people and gets them out of off the street and eventually back into apartments of their own. And so they have, I would say, considerable more expenses than your normal GRH would have.
Madam Chair, I'm aware of that as well. We understand that it is a special program, particularly the mental health treatment that's available there. And I understand that, I assume that that is the purpose of why the additional funds had been added. As I said before, we generally...
they don't qualify for the rehab dollars either. So, are there any other questions on this page? All right, let's go on then.
Madam Chair, page 17, our technical corrections. There were some mistakes made in base level riders from last year. You can see the adjustments in the out years related to that. There was also a mistake made in the TANF rider. I believe we sent a letter to the chairs about that at the time. This aligns the TANF rider with the way we actually implemented the TANF refinancing at the end of last session.
Are there any questions about this page? If not, let's go on.
Madam Chair, page 18 represents savings from special revenue funds balances within Children and Family Services area. These would be in the child support area and in the children child welfare area. Right now, what we're representing here are the estimated amounts of savings that we will get. We will look at the end of the year as to how we actually apportion where we take the dollars from. There are other special revenue savings pages within the DHS budget. We'll be coordinating that across the department.
So does that mean that the numbers on this page aren't right?
Madam Chair, these are the numbers of savings that we will produce. It's just how, where exactly we'll take the dollars from that we want to be able to review closer to the end of the year.
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, my question is, what do we attribute the fact that there's balances left at the end of the year in those accounts, particularly in child support and child welfare? Does that mean that all of those families that are in need of those services, that the need is being met, and in fact there's too much money appropriated there?
Madam Chair and Senator Lynch, these are special revenue accounts, which means that there's dedicated revenue coming from some source, often a federal source, that goes into them. And the federal revenue is allowed to stay in that account and carry forward to the next year. Sometimes there may be balances because there's been some kind of underspending in this year or the previous year, and so a balance has built up. In some cases, the balance is only because we're looking at using the money differently going into the future year. And so the balance doesn't necessarily represent money that wouldn't be used. It's money that we would carry forward and use perhaps in a different way in the next year. I think there's an adoption account, for example, that funds some of the grants that we have with private agencies to help with public-private adoption work for getting kids who are in foster care who've had parental rights terminated adopted. That's a place where we use that money to grant to make grants with those private organizations. If we have a less balanced one year, we may need to ratchet back a little bit how much we're paying those agencies. So it depends on which special revenue fund you're looking at as to try to figure out what the impact is. For the most part, it's not services that go directly to people. There's a piece of it's child welfare training. There's a piece that's adoption, as I mentioned, adoptions account. There's a grant. There's one in the one of these balances actually is the Healthy Marriage Project in the child support area that I mentioned before. We're rededicating or we're undedicating the funds to flow back to the general fund. There's actually a balance there right now of $113,000 that we're also proposing here to put up back into the general fund for savings purposes. So it's a variety of small accounts with very different reasons as to why there may be money there at a given point in time.
Other questions about this page? If not, let's move on then.
Madam Chair, that is the end of the Children and Family Services section.
Thank you very much. And let's move on to Billy Joe Zielinski, Assistant Commissioner of Health.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Billy Joe Zielinski. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Healthcare Administration at the Department of Human Services. Glad to be here today before you. As you know, the Healthcare Administration is responsible for the state's publicly subsidized healthcare programs, providing healthcare coverage for about 707,000 Minnesotans, many of them families with children, elderly.
Maybe you could direct us to the section.
You bet. I was just giving, Madam Chair, an overview, as this is my first time here. So we are going to be, for continuity of presentation, Brian Osberg's and my proposals are in one section together, but we are going to be skipping through some pages so that we don't have to alternate. So page 3 is where my section begins.
And which of the blue sections is
the healthcare, right after Children Family Services, the healthcare portion.
It's not in our book, it's not. Long-term one care more, is the next further. Section.
One blue, one further.
Section 5. Maybe that helps. Sorry, section 5.
Section 4 or 5?
Section 5. My apologies, Madam Chair. Page 3 is where I will direct your attention first. Madam Chair, members of the committee, this proposal eliminates coverage of physical, occupational, and speech therapies for non-pregnant adults age 21 and above on Minnesota Care and Medical Assistance effective January 1, 2011. Therapy will continue to be available in inpatient settings. Rehabilitation services, which include physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech language pathology, and audiology services, are characterized as optional rather than mandatory for certain populations as defined by the federal regulations. In fiscal year 2010-11, this proposal will save $1.8 million from the general fund, $285,000 in the healthcare access fund. In fiscal year 2012-13, it'll save $11.5 million in the general fund and $1.3 million in the healthcare access fund. Currently, rehabilitative services are available to all Minnesota healthcare program participants, whether under the fee-for-service or the managed care plans. elderly and people with disabilities with long-term chronic and debilitating conditions, as well as children with chronic lifelong conditions such as cerebral palsy, receive the majority of the rehabilitative services paid for by the Minnesota healthcare programs. Medicare includes coverage for rehabilitative services and for those recipients who are duly eligible for Medicare and Medicaid. Minnesota healthcare programs pays for their coinsurance and deductible, and it is anticipated that this will continue should rehabilitative services be eliminated from the Minnesota healthcare program benefit set. For children who are under 21, the program will continue to include rehabilitative services under the early and periodic screening, diagnostic, and treatment benefit, but many children with the lifelong disabling conditions receive PTOT and the speech-language pathology over and above the EPSDT benefit set.
So we've seen this proposal before, and we've had concerns about it in the past. That's why it wasn't implemented last year. Are there any questions about it? If not, let's go on.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, now I will direct your attention to page 6. Chair, members of the committee, this proposal would modify the criteria to qualify for critical access dental add-on payments. Under this proposal, fewer dentists will qualify for the payment. This proposal dovetails with the one-time critical access dental elimination in the unallotment package. We want to save money, but we also want to preserve critical access dental payments for clinics with the mission to serve disproportionately large numbers of public program clients, uninsured and underinsured individuals, regardless of their ability to pay. This proposal will save $3 million in fiscal year 2011 in the Healthcare Access Fund. In fiscal year 2012-13, it will save $8 million in the General Fund and $13.2 million in the Healthcare Access Fund. This proposal alters the criteria for dentists to be designated a critical access dental provider under medical assistance and Minnesota Care. Specifically, state law would require that CAD providers be nonprofit clinics, community clinics that have nonprofit status as specified under state law, have tax-exempt status as provided in Internal Revenue Code Section 501c3, are established to provide oral health services to low-income population groups, uninsured, high-risk and special needs populations, underserved and other special needs populations, have professional staff familiar with cultural background of clients, charge for services on a sliding fee scale designed to provide assistance to low-income clients based on current poverty income guidelines and family size, do not restrict access or services because of clients' financial limitations or public assistance, and have free care available as needed. In addition, federally qualified healthcare centers, rural healthcare centers, public health clinics, state-operated dental clinics, and county-based hospital clinics are eligible for the designation for critical access provider.
So what percentage of the folks that were qualifying for critical access dental payments would be eliminated under this proposal?
Madam Chair, I would like to ask a member of my staff to come up, and I don't have that in front of me. We'll have to provide that to you. I'm sorry, I don't have that information, Madam Chair.
And then maybe the next question that I could ask is, why is there a bias against private dental offices that might be choosing to serve large numbers of public clients? I'm just thinking that this proposal is going to create some geographic access issues because every community doesn't have a public clinic available.
Madam Chair, I would like to invite Chris Reisdorf from a member of my staff.
Madam Chair, members, Chris Reiser from the Department of Human Services. I think our goal with this proposal, knowing that we do have to take money out of the budget to send the money to clinics that are whose mission it is to serve our clients and those who are uninsured, in a way to direct money to the clinics who probably most need this additional money.
Right, but there are a lot of communities that don't have this, don't have these types of clinics available.
Madam Chair, that is correct.
So do we know how many critical access dental providers there are in those communities that would be eliminated through this proposal?
Madam Chair, we will get that information back to you. This does limit the number of critical access dental providers to a small number. We do not know how many providers would choose to not serve our clients if they did not receive the critical access dental add-on.
Oh, almost all of them. I mean, it's happening right now out there because of the unallotment. Senator Laurie.
Madam Chair, I'm just really curious, without these very basic facts, how we came up with a fiscal estimate, what this would do. I mean, it seems like we'd need to know some estimate of who would quit providing these services before we could put a number on a sheet.
Madam Chair, Senator, we do have, I don't have the number with me, but it is a small number of providers that would qualify under this. We don't, however, know how many providers would stop serving clients if the critical access dental add-on was not available to them.
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair and Ms. Reisner, just a casual observation. I have done a little work in this area, and we struggle to keep the current private dentists in critical access now. So I don't think that there'd be a lot of study that would need to be done to determine the impact that this would have on those providers. I think they've sent us a very clear message in this division over time.
Senator Rosen, did you have any other questions? Let's move on then.
Madam Chair, now I'll direct your attention to page 13. I'm sorry, I apologize. Page 10, sorry. Madam Chair, members of the committee, this proposal reduces the eligibility for adults without children on Minnesota Care to 75% of the federal poverty guidelines effective October 1, 2010. This proposal will save $130 million in the Healthcare Access Fund in fiscal year 2010-11 and $510 million in the Healthcare Access Fund in fiscal year 2012-13. This proposal will decrease the average monthly enrollment by 28,000 enrollees. This proposal will not violate the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act maintenance of effort requirement because Minnesota Care adults, as you know, without children are not a federally funded eligibility group. This one's pretty straightforward, Madam Chair.
So how many would be eliminated over the total course of the rest of the biennium?
Madam Chair.
And I guess as long as we're needing help to answer the question, how many would be eliminated in the next biennium?
Madam Chair, I would like to invite Dave Greenman to, I just have the one number.
Madam Chair, Dave Greenman with the Department of Human Services. I missed part of the question.
How many would be eliminated from coverage?
Okay.
The rest of this biennium, and how many in the next biennium?
Average monthly enrollment reduction in fiscal year 12 would be about 30,700. The reduction in average monthly enrollment in fiscal year 13 would be about 31,400. Madam Chair.
What is the 28,000 then that we just heard?
Oh, okay. Madam Chair, sorry, it will decrease enrollment by 28,000 enrollees at the end of this biennium. 28,000. It's not an average monthly enrollment. My apologies.
And then these other numbers,
are average monthly enrollment, Madam Chair.
That's average monthly enrollment, mm-hmm. So we would multiply those by 12.
To get the number of, Madam Chair, I believe to get the number of months of less enrollment.
To get the total number of people that would be no longer covered during the biennium.
Madam Chair, the first year is just 9 months, and so that would be the 28,000 enrollees.
And after that?
Madam Chair, on average, over the 12-month period, there would be 30,700 fewer people enrolled in fiscal year 12, on average, over the 12-month period. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question.
No, you're not.
Okay.
I appreciate that information, but the question is how many would not have coverage over the biennium.
Madam Chair, I think we would have to get that information for you. But we will do that.
You need the aggregate.
Other questions, Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think just following up on the question, obviously some people come on the program and are going to stay on it over a period of time. Some people are going to come on and go off. And so it probably isn't fair to say 30,000 times 12 would be the appropriate number, but on the other hand, it's going to be a lot more than 30,000 people because some come on and go off. So it seems like the department would have some idea in making this recommendation. Is it going to be 100,000, 150,000? I'm guessing that you have some idea how many people would lose their health care over the course of a year. And I think I can't understand how you could make a recommendation like that and not have some kind of an idea how many people.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I think you're right. I mean, I think that's what Senator Berglund's asking is us to get that number. When we calculate the impact of this proposal, what we look at is average monthly enrollment so that we can calculate the fiscal impact. So we didn't necessarily look at the number of people who would be coming on and off the program during that period that will not now not be coming on and off the program. But we will look into that.
Could we also get the enrollment by county presently?
Madam Chair, yes.
Senator Lynch?
Madam Chair, with the proposal to move from 250% to 75%, would that be similar to currently in GAMC? We're at 75%. Thank you.
Senator Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The other day I had constituents in the office, as we all are now, who are worried about concerns, and I was talking a little bit with Senator Sharon about this the other day. We were trying to figure out exactly where this young woman was, but she was saying, and I wonder if this is the cut that she was talking about or anticipating, but she's got some chronic health problems, and she's young, and she's single, without children. And she said, you know, cuts in her health care support are really going to encourage a lot of young women to get pregnant and have children in order to stay on some kind of health care assistance. I wonder if that's going to be a consequence of some of these program cuts for single adults without children. Just putting that out there. It seems like we squeeze people too hard on one program, and you know, there's a lot of people unable to work because of chronic health problems that are on the edge and need care. And I would just hate to see a lot of young women making decisions like this in order to continue their coverage.
I think think another consequence could be more people trying to go through the disability door. Minnesota Care was created as a program to reward work. And I would say this is definitely a step away from that, because most of the people that would be eligible for this program would no longer probably be working or not working very much.
Senator Berglund?
Senator Sharon?
I want to emphasize what you're saying. I'm looking at what the, reminding this committee what 75% is. It's $650 for one person, $875 for two, and $1,100 for three. An asset limit of $1,000 per household.
Well, this is people without children, so it'd just be one or two.
So it'd be one and two. So just to emphasize that we're talking about a public policy here that completely changes what Minnesota Care is about. It's no longer a program that allows people who are working and not earning enough to afford health care to have access to health care. So those are the people that are going to be impacted by this, and only the very poorest of the poor would be eligible any longer, which is what general assistance medical care is supposed to be about that the governor just vetoed. So that's what we're talking about here. And I think that this, along with what is being proposed to do for dental access, taking away the ability to use all of our providers throughout the state to provide access to health care to the very poor, is a very lousy public policy, short-sighted, and we should be ashamed of ourselves if we support this.
The only other thing I can add is that I think that the program, Minnesota Care program, is very helpful to small employers. A lot of small employers can't afford to offer health insurance to their employees. And when they know that their employees can get into Minnesota Care, then they don't have to worry so much about, you know, investing, training in an employee and having them just turn around and leave because they really need a job that provides health care coverage. Lynch?
Madam Chair, I know that there's going to be opportunities forthcoming for people to provide comment on these various proposals, and I hope that we will hear from the Minnesota Hospital Association on this particular item, particularly in terms of how something like this potentially impacts their uncompensated care.
Senator Rosen?
Well, Madam Chair, I'm going to say something that we can continue to have these discussions. I, too, Senator Sharon, I'm concerned about the critical dental issue and a couple other pieces in here. But I'm also very concerned about the small business employer. I mean, you know, we're going down a path where we cannot sustain what we have. And we will have these discussions on the floor, and they'll be very impassioned. But we have a system set up where we are not creating the jobs. Nobody wants to invest in Minnesota and sustain their business here. They would love to have a way of getting out of Minnesota to do business in some other state that doesn't tax them to death and regulate them to death and mandate them to death. So, you know, I'm sitting here and I'm thinking, you know, hold your fire, Senator Rosen, Julie, but it's very hard to look at these cuts but also say we are on a spiral down. So if we want to keep going down and taxing and taxing, well, there won't be anything to tax because everybody's, I mean, businesses are struggling, and I can say that personally, so.
Senator Rosen, nobody in this committee has been talking about a tax increase.
Well, Madam Chair, I think that's the end product here.
Not necessarily.
No, I hope not.
This committee's never proposed a tax increase. It's not even in the jurisdiction of this committee. Are there other questions about this page?
Oh, just that
Sharon.
I've also noticed we aren't there yet, but there's a proposal also to reduce the DRGs for rural providers. The DRG increases that we had for the rural providers on page 8. And
we'll
although
get
we
there.
we will get there, but I'm just responding to this discussion that that we made, that what we do here does create an environment in which the costs for health insurance are shifted onto private pay. And when that happens, it does impact our small businesses. So we harm our small businesses with these policies. We don't help them.
Any other questions or comments? Senator Olson.
Well, and I'll just quickly say to follow up on that, that nowhere is that more true than in areas of rural Minnesota where we have less ability to have a payment mix to spread this pain around that we cause. And a lot of people who are relying on MinnesotaCare as their health care program, disproportionately high number in rural Minnesota. So I'm really concerned that the impact of the governor's proposals are disproportionately going to come out of rural Minnesota.
Any other questions or concerns? Okay, let's go on then.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we do recognize to reach the level of savings necessary that there will be impacts to recipients and providers. Madam Chair, now I'll direct the members of the committee and yourself to page 13, please. This proposal increases the maximum MinnesotaCare premium from 7.2% to 8.8% of household income effective July 1, 2011. This proposal will save $9.5 million in fiscal year 2012-13 in the Health Care Access Fund. Under this proposal, enrollment will decrease by 239 enrollees in 2011, 882 enrollees in 2012, and 1,143 enrollees in 2013. Under this proposal, MinnesotaCare premiums would revert from the current scale with a maximum of 7.2% of household income to the prior premium scale with a maximum premium of 8.8% of household income. Since this would maintain MinnesotaCare premiums within the ceiling set out in the MinnesotaCare waiver, an amendment to the waiver would not be needed to implement this change.
So this is a really good time to raise premiums in MinnesotaCare, I would say, when the public is struggling financially. And I have a feeling somehow that all of these pages about MinnesotaCare are really because of the department's auto enrollment policy for GAMC, which I believe is not in keeping with the law. The law says you only auto-enroll people that are not homeless, not suffering from HIV, AIDS, not applying for disability. So I guess I think that if we were not violating the law, we wouldn't be having all these pages about MinnesotaCare in front of us. Are there any other questions or comments about this page? Let's go on then.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would now like to draw your attention to page 14. This proposal has no fiscal impact. As you can see, it gives the commissioner the authority to carry forward the unexpended FY 2010 appropriation for the state COBRA subsidy program to FY 2011. The additional funds will cover the cost of complying with the new federal COBRA subsidy provisions. The state COBRA legislation passed in 2009 appropriated $22.6 million in FY 10 and $6.9 million in FY 2011 to pay for the state subsidy on the COBRA premiums. The fiscal note projected that the subsidies would result in a reduction in the cost of MinnesotaCare and medical assistance programs, but that the program would result in a net cost to the state. early experience with the program has found that the expenditures on the state COBRA premium subsidies have been much lower than anticipated. Likewise, the savings to the Minnesota healthcare programs has been much lower than expected. This proposal would authorize the carry forward of the original 2009 appropriation for the state COBRA premium subsidies, which will be sufficient to cover the costs of the both complying with the changes to the federal the COBRA subsidy program on the federal level and allow the Minnesota state COBRA subsidy to be extended to correspond with the changes to the federal COBRA subsidy.
So the question I have, the reason we did this was because it was cost benefit. If not very many people are using this option, I guess the question I have is there still cost benefit to the expenditure?
There are, Madam Chair, there are member, let me see if I have that. Madam Chair, Karen Giusto.
Madam Chair, Karen Giusto, Department of Human Services. In answer to your question, there is a cost benefit, but what we're seeing is that the cost benefit that we originally anticipated would occur within the current authority under state law will actually be realized over the larger course of the extension of this under the federal COBRA subsidy. So over in carry forwarding the dollars to be able to continue to provide the subsidy through December, we hope to capture that savings over the longer term.
Could we get some documentation that would show us that?
Madam Chair, yes, we can supply that for you.
And does this request also have an increase in complement to the department? We were investigating this issue earlier in the year, and we were told that it would require that the whole project is more labor intensive than originally anticipated and would require additional complement.
Madam Chair, given that under current state law, the Minnesota COBRA premium subsidy is through December of 2011, we would not require December of 2010, we would not require additional staff. If we were to additionally extend that to, I believe it's May of 2011, which would fully permit people to have the Minnesota COBRA subsidy for the same amounts of time that they would have the federal COBRA subsidy, that would require some FTE complement. But this change in and of itself does not.
Thank you. Are there other questions? All right, let's move on then.
Madam Chair, that concludes my portion.
Okay.
Was that this person? Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Brian Osberg, I'm State Medicaid Director. Also have other responsibilities, including managed care contracting and inpatient payment policy. And those are the issues I'm going to be addressing this morning. Before we get started, I'd like to give you some good news, and that is we last night were informed by the Department of Health and Human Services, the federal department, that the states will have a correction in their Medicare Part D clawback provision. If you recall, when Medicare Part D went into effect a few years ago, there were savings to the states. And so what the federal government did was call back, as they say, that savings. Well, they did that based on our 50% federal match. When the enhanced match under ARRA this past year went 61.59% through calendar year 10, we challenged CMS saying, wait a minute, you need to recalculate this based on our federal match and the fact that we're having a lower state match. And so we as a collective group, National Association of State Medicaid Directors, challenged CMS on that. And last night, the Secretary of Health and Human Services announced that they will refund the states for that difference. And that's $81 million for this biennium.
Congratulations.
Can I finish there? And,
yes.
Now, back
well,
to,
I was due for some good news.
Yes. And we're also trying to, of course, encourage the enactment of other legislation that would support states further around. There was an issue a few years ago that the federal government, Medicare, inappropriately determined that some people were not eligible for disability coverage, and so Medicaid picked that up. Now they realize that they should have been eligible for Medicare coverage, and that's around $35 to $50 million issue for us. And so we're trying to get legislation enacted. If we don't get legislation enacted to correct that and get that refund, then we'll have to go after providers and have third-party recovery and correct the payment arrangement. That would be very timely and somewhat onerous. So we're hoping some legislation is enacted to do that as well.
So, Assistant Commissioner, I guess you're not an Assistant Commissioner anymore. You're a director now.
State
All right,
Medicaid
Director Osberg, will this $81 million show up in the forecast?
Madam Chair, yes. I expect that. I have not talked to George yet today, but I expect that would be in the forecast and for the February forecast.
It would be March.
March. Yeah, it would be the March forecast.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, between these two numbers, that $81 million that we didn't know apparently before we were going to have, that's a surplus, and the $35 to $50 million, could be looking at as much as $131 million. I'm just wondering whether that money is potentially available to solve the GAMC problem. I mean, is it tied up because of how funding streams work, or is it something that could be transferred in that direction?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Olson, as the Chair just indicated, it will be reflected in the forecast, so it will be $81 million less in terms of a deficit in the forecast.
Well, Madam Chair, is the short answer that we could use that money if we chose to do that then?
Madam Chair, that money will be reflected in the forecast. So, yeah, it can be used for whatever purposes the state decides.
All right.
Lessen the deficit. There's not going to be a surplus because of $81 million in the forecast. But, on page one of this section, section five in healthcare, the first item is the managed care withhold relating to Minnesota Care. The governor recommends increasing the amount withheld from 5% up to 8%, additional 3% in terms of the withhold from the managed care payments. Last year, the governor recommended this. In fact, the legislature intended to enact this change to increase the withhold from managed care payments up to 8%. And that's the withhold that we have in the medical assistance side. Unfortunately, the language was not included to give us the authorization to do that in last year's bill. So this does that. This provides the language necessary to increase the Minnesota care managed care payments up to 8%. Now, this 3% is not based, the determination of the 3% or the treatment of the 3% is not based on performance of the health plan. The 5% is. 5% of the withhold is returned based on performance of the health plan. The 3% is not. That is simply returned at a later point. And so I want to make sure you understand that distinction. So this 3% is not subject to performance measurements.
So, Director Osberg, the numbers on this page are tied to the page that eliminates coverage for many people in Minnesota Care. We'd like to get the numbers if that action is not taken by the legislature.
Madam Chair, we will provide that to you. As you'll see that this proposal saves $7.7 million in the Healthcare Access Fund this biennium and $24 million in the next biennium.
Any questions about this page?
I think I'm on the wrong page. Would you remind me which page?
We're on page one of the healthcare section, which is section five. All right, let's move on then.
Madam Chair, members of page two of this section, this proposal will reduce by 3% fee-for-service payments to inpatient hospital services, effective July 1st, 2010. This proposal excludes facilities operated by the Indian Health Services. It also requires payments to managed care plans to be reduced for services provided on or after January 1, 2011 to reflect this reduction. We want to ensure that the entire reduction is reflected in the managed care arrangement, but we're trying to avoid a mid-year amendment. So we will change the contract effective January 1st in managed care to reflect the full effect of this 3% rate of reduction.
I guess I just really have to start questioning this business about you can't change anything in a health plan contract until the next contract year. I know you just sent out a change in the contract. It wasn't negotiated. It wasn't anything. It was just sent out informing the plans that this was a change to their contract.
Madam Chair, a number of things. One is that we need to allow for time for the managed care organizations to, of course, change their arrangements to make this happen. Number two is getting federal approval and getting a federal approval on the amendment to the agreement, and which is, seems would be easy to do. But frankly, we came up to the last minute this past year with any amendments that we had for last October 1st. You're right. We made a change midstream to the managed care arrangements.
Well, and it was done just this past month as well.
And Madam Chair, but we have the process of getting those amendments approved by the federal government is difficult. We're capturing all of the important things. We're capturing all the savings here. We're not delaying this, the effect, as I said. We're capturing all of that. So the January 1 change in terms of rates to managed care organizations will reflect the July 1st effective date. So we'll capture that 6 month period of time in terms of savings in the amount that we pay the managed care organizations in.
So you
January.
Retroactively amend their contract?
That's not that's where we have to be careful, Madam Chair.
I don't understand how you're going to get the savings otherwise.
Madam Chair, we are able to do that. We're able to get the savings in terms of how we contract. The rates that will be put in place on January 1st will reflect that 6 month period of time. It's not a, we cannot under current federal law have a retroactive change to any contract. That's
so you
not
just
permitted.
make the reduction deeper for the.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Are there other questions about this page? Let's move on then.
Madam Chair, on page 5. This proposal eliminates a portion of the medical education and research cost payments attributable to managed care capitation payments, effective July 1st, 2010. The funding eliminated here is the entire amount reserved for the general distribution to eligible hospital and clinic training sites, and we can provide that list if you wish as to which providers are affected by that. There's two aspects of this on the managed care MRC arrangement. One is the general distribution piece, which is a total of $49 million, with a state share of roughly $18.8 or $19 million. And then there's the fixed amount that we pay back to the University of Minnesota and to the Hennepin County Medical Center. That will be retained. That $21 million payment that we currently have in law, MRC payment to the University of Minnesota and to Hennepin County Medical Center, will not be affected by this. It's the general distribution part of the MRC payments that will be affected. And as indicated here, it will be a $18.8 million savings to the general fund for this biennium.
And Director Osberg, why is this one-time money?
Because, Madam Chair, we're doing it for just this period of time, I believe.
I guess I'm asking why the decision was made to do it on a one-time basis.
Madam Chair, as you can imagine, all these cuts are difficult to make, and the effect of this is a $49 million effect overall to hospitals and $19 million state share, so it's $30 million of federal money that they lose because of this cut. That's the biggest reason that this is. It has greater federal share, primarily because of the enhanced FMAP. But we want to make this an interim cut, Madam Chair.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Osberg, I would like to request a list of all of the entities that will be affected. And additionally, I would request, as I have done on some previous items, because of the ties here with the University of Minnesota, I think that it is important for the agency to provide information regarding this proposal to the Senate Higher Education Chair, Senator Pappas. And so I would ask that you follow up with her office on this page as well. And I'd be interested in your thoughts on why or how it was determined that some of the payments were to remain intact for some of the institutions and some not, and what was the thought process involved there?
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, we wanted to minimize this. We didn't want to take the entire effect, and at this point, we opted to take this portion of it and want to retain the other piece. Now, I believe in the Minnesota Department of Health's proposal on their Merck piece, the University of Minnesota is affected by that slightly. So this, in this case, we want to keep the University of Minnesota whole in terms of this portion, the fixed payment off of the managed care payment arrangement. So we didn't want to certainly to eliminate all of the Merck funding under the managed care payment arrangement.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Would it be fair to say that once again this proposal from the governor is going to disproportionately harm hospitals in rural Minnesota? I mean, that's what it looks like to me.
Madam Chair, no, I don't.
No,
I don't,
I've been hearing
so.
From Metro hospitals about this
right.
already.
Yeah, you're right.
Children's, I think, is real upset about it.
No, in fact, I would guess it'd be more the Metro effect than the rural effect.
I'm sure when we take testimony on the governor's budget, we'll hear more about it. Are there other questions about this page? Senator Lynch?
Madam Chair, Mr. Osberg, and a follow-up if I could. Sometimes over time and with these budget pages as they're presented, it's difficult for us to remember the cumulative effect of some of these cuts because some of these items have been before us in previous cycles. And I would be interested with regard to Merck to see the cumulative effect of decisions that have been made and, frankly, what's left in Merck. Because I think, you know, at some point in time, the question needs to be asked, are we really committed to medical education and research in this state or not? And I think this might be an appropriate time to take a look at that. So if you could help us so that we can see more clearly the cumulative longitudinal effects, I think that'd be helpful.
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, we'll do that. We'll work with the Health Department to put together a review of that for you.
Any other questions about this page? No, let's move on.
Madam Chair, members, page 8. Again, we realize the effect of this on hospitals, especially non-metro hospitals, but this proposal eliminates the enhanced payment to hospitals in greater Minnesota for certain diagnoses. And it's primarily delivery diagnoses and mental health diagnoses. There's 16 DRGs we're talking about, and they're mental health and delivery diagnoses. This proposal eliminates that add-on effective July 1st of this year.
Madam Chair.
And would this be in, is this just in the fee-for-service system?
Madam Chair, I would have to find out that. I'll get that back. I'll get back to you on this to that. I don't know if that would be the case necessarily. I don't know that. I'll have to get back to you. I apologize. Yes. Well, I've been told, yes, it would affect managed care. arrangement, so this would also be reflected in the contract that we would. Okay, she said to me that it would be fee for service only. I apologize.
Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, again, I'm just wondering, kind of to add on to what's already been said, if we could get some kind of a graph that shows the numbers on cumulatively on these cuts on various hospitals around the state.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, one quick way of doing that is looking at the Hospital Association's spreadsheet that they provided to you, and they indicated where there's a rural DRG column, indicate which hospitals would have been affected by an increase. I believe there was a proposal at one point or discussion about going up to 100% of the metro average. You get an indication there, but we can provide to you, and we provided that list to the MHA, so we can provide to you which hospitals are eligible for this. Now, let me tell you how this works. In fact, one thing I think would be useful, not only understand how MRC may work, but I think it may be useful for the committee to understand how all of our hospital payments work. It's, as you know, very convoluted and complex as to the various hospital payment arrangements we have. Everything from IGT payments to DSH payments, quarterly payments to add-ons to small hospital, rural hospital add-ons beyond this, and to how we calculate the rebasing piece. We provided some information last year to the committee, I believe, about that, but I would encourage the committee to understand, and we'll provide that information as to how we go about paying hospitals overall, not just the MRC piece. And that way you get an understanding as to the inner actions of some of those arrangements, because how this works is that the hospitals get paid their cost based on their cost, their specific cost. That's how hospitals get paid through our program. Now, there's a lag on that. There's a four-month lag on that. But it's scheduled in statute. Every other year, there's a rebasing of that. We'll get to that issue in a minute. But
and how long has it been delayed?
It's been delayed a number of years. Yes, right, in about 4 years. I think 2007 is the last time. But
and I think
the point I'm trying to make
here that delays it.
It delays it further. But the point is that the hospitals get paid on their cost, based on their cost, their historical cost. And so what this arrangement does is say that, okay, if their historical costs are less than 90% of the metro average, which by and large are more expensive hospitals, have higher costs, then they get paid 90% of the metro average. That's how that works. And the question is whether or not that's a viable way, an appropriate way of reimbursing hospitals. So I think the methodology itself needs to be thought through.
Madam Chair.
Notwithstanding the effect that we have on the hospitals near term.
Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, I guess the one thing you said that I strongly agree with is the fact that the methodology needs to be reexamined. We sat down with a business director for North Country Regional Hospital several months ago and went through, explaining both at the state and federal level how these payment rates were impacting that particular hospital. And most of their expenses are with regard to personnel costs, salaries. And in order to get doctors and other medical professionals particularly doctors, to come to that hospital, it's often the case that that hospital has to pay as much as 50% more in salary to attract a doctor to come to that hospital. And so just like in other countries where there are remote areas where people don't necessarily want to go for a variety of reasons, and in those countries you can actually add a bonus on top of the payment to get someone to go there, then they don't have those capacity or access issues. We do the opposite, and so we really have our payment structure misaligned with what it takes to provide that kind of access. So, for example, a personal example, when I called to try to get a physical appointment in November at the hospital or the clinic in Bemidji, I will have an appointment in June because that's about how long it takes on average to get in to see a family practice doctor because of the extreme shortage of doctors. It seems to me that the whole idea of going through rebasing, which is expensive and time-consuming, so it continues to get pushed off into the future. I mean, first of all, to me, it's kind of an unfair premise, because if you've been having to cut everything and then it's based on your costs, well, you're just kind of reinforcing a system that isn't working through rebasing. It isn't saying what would it really take to provide the same level of services in different geographic areas around the state. And I think whatever the arguments are for it being more expensive in one place versus the other, I mean, in one place maybe housing is less, but that has nothing really to do with the cost of running a facility. In other places you have economies of scale in larger metro areas. It just seems to me that this whole system needs to be either reexamined, or if we can't get some money out to rural hospitals and nursing homes fairly, then maybe we should scrap the idea of rebasing and just level the playing field.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I agree. I think we should reexamine this, the way we reimburse hospitals in general. And I'm glad to do that with this committee.
Senator Lynch, may I ask?
Senator Sharon.
Would you help me understand how, in addition to the reductions that we just talked about a few moments ago, you came to the conclusion that this was a reasonable idea to further reduce, to eliminate the inpatient Greater Minnesota Hospital 60 add-on payments? Other than, gee, this is a place where we can find some more money to balance the to resolve the deficit. What was the thinking behind making this proposal?
Mr. Osberg.
Madam Chair and Senator Sharon, again, the idea here is to find the necessary savings. We think that this area is one area in which we could do that, that minimizes the effect, potentially on eligibility cuts, for example. We'd rather, at this point, look at provider cuts than further eligibility cuts. Those are the kind of trade-offs that I'm afraid we're looking at with the kind of deficit that we're facing. And so, there, as I said before, there's I'm not suggesting we're doing this just because it's a bad methodology. It's an issue. I think the methodology needs to be revisited. It's unfortunately, we have to find provider cuts, and the hospital cuts are part of that. And this, again, small rural hospitals also have a 15 or 20% add-on independent of this. That's a separate part of the arrangement that we have. Again, I think it's important that you understand all of the ways we pay hospitals here and how this all compares. I'm not suggesting that they're overpaid or anything necessary. The hospitals are facing difficult times, and they're going to have to rely on their retained earnings, their fund balance, in order to get through this difficult time. And hopefully this will be a short period of time in which
these fund balances, Senator, are fictional. Sharon. Thank you, Senator Lynch. May I ask you why? First of all, you know, I understand, we agree about the need to do rebasing, which continues to be delayed, and that Senator Olson spoke eloquently about the flaws in how that base rate is established now, because it just completely demonstrates the lack of understanding of what it takes to provide healthcare services in the rural part of the state, and does not account for those things in calculating the base rate. But aside from that, why not, rather than focus specifically on rural hospitals, DRGs, add an additional reduction to all hospitals throughout the state?
Mr. Osberg.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, as you see, there's a ratable reduction that affects all hospitals. There's a MRC reduction that affects a lot of hospitals. This rural DRG piece affects a number of hospitals. The rebasing delay that we're going to talk about in a minute affects all hospitals. So all hospitals are affected by these proposals, and it is a significant hit on hospitals. I'm not suggesting it's not. Again, it's an issue of trade-offs as to what do we do in order to meet the necessary target for reducing our deficit. And this is what we're presenting to you as the as better of the bad choices.
I understand. I understand.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Senator Lynch. I'm sorry. I'm finding that I've heard a statement throughout the summer when we're looking at the bonding bill about what's nice and not necessary. Nice but not necessary. I think that was the line we've been hearing. I'm starting to learn that Minnesota rural communities are nice but not necessary.
I'm hopeful and actually confident as we hear testimony on this from the public, I'm confident that the Minnesota Hospital Association will help to clarify the proposals that are being presented here today. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to follow up on the comment you made, I think in fairness, you'd have to acknowledge that rural Minnesota hospitals are being hit for the most part, and granted there are some metro hospitals that, you know, that are particularly more similarly situated to the situation faced by rural hospitals. But a couple of these funding streams are specifically beneficial to the hospitals because they're struggling the most, because they have the narrowest margins for the most part and the most difficult time. And we're taking some cuts across the board, but then we're adding on and layering on cuts to programs that specifically are directed toward primarily those rural Minnesota hospitals that are having the most difficult time, and adding those on top. So it seems to me that Senator Sharon's, not that I support the cuts across the board in terms of whether we that's where we should be balancing our budget, but if we are going to be looking at hospitals, we should be at least having an overall financial impact that's proportionate, as opposed to more weighing more of that pain on our rural Minnesota hospitals or hospitals in general that are struggling the most.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, let us make that assessment and get back to you. I'm not sure if that's the case. I really don't, because this point, this item, for example, is a $2 million item. Whereas the Merck piece was a $19 million item, whereas the rebasing piece, I'll get to that in a minute, is a $9 million item. Let us make that assessment. I think that's a good question. And certainly it's not by design. No, we're not suggesting sitting here and trying to figure out how to make this more difficult for rural hospitals. Let us do that. The best we can. Now, we can't tell you exactly the effect of the rebasing. I need to remind the committee, the rebasing piece is based on individual hospitals' costs. So if a hospital does have higher costs because they have, that's how it works. Zach, Senator Sharon, that's how it works. It's based on an individual hospital cost. And so if a hospital does have higher costs because of recruitment necessary for physicians, it will be reflected in that. Now, there's a four-year lag in terms of the cost period that we look at. That is an issue. I grant it, that's an issue. And so I still think the methodology around that is flawed as well in terms of how we do that. We do the best we can based on what's in statute, that our hospital reimbursement is based on individual hospital costs. It's very unusual.
Senator Olson.
And Madam Chair, again, that's really misleading, because if one particular community hospital has to search for 18 months to try to find a doctor who's willing to accept a particular salary because that's all they can afford to pay, then is it fair to set their cost based at that level when someone else can find a doctor easily because they can afford to pay them more, and then they reflect a higher cost? I mean, it just doesn't really make any sense, because you're artificially limiting at the outset what the hospital has in terms of a financial ability to pay.
Madam Chair, Senator, I agree. Cost reimbursement was thrown out by Medicare 20, 30 years ago, and we still have it. Okay. I think it should be rethought. The whole method of why we pay hospitals services should be reinvented, in my opinion.
And with that, Mr. Osberg, I'm going to ask you to please continue.
Okay. Speaking of hospital cuts, page 16. Close it back.
Mr. Osberg.
This proposal delays hospital rebasing for 3 months until April 1st, 2011. For the rebasing period that begins on January 1st, 2011. Under current law, what happened last year during the legislation that was enacted last year, there was a rebasing was kept in place, but only 74% of the effect or the value of the rebasing was going to be brought back to the hospitals. We're suggesting that that be delayed, that none of that take place for the first quarter of 2011. And then for 12 months after that, under current law, the value of the rebasing is 39% of the effect. So again, that was passed by the legislature last year. So from April 1st, of 2011 to April 1st, 2012, 39% of the rebasing value will go back to the hospitals. 60% was kept to balance or to provide savings for last year. And so what happens that is April 1st of 2012, the full effect, full value of rebasing will go into effect. So we delay the 74% of rebasing. We take that away for the first 3 months of 2011. Then the 39% of the rebasing value goes into effect for 12 months. Then the full value of the 2011 rebasing goes into effect until 2013, when we rebase all over again, because we rebase under statute every other year. Did that help? Because the effect of that is, as I said, $8.6 million in the general fund for this biennium.
Please continue.
Madam Chair, that is the last health care budget page that we have.
Any additional questions from the committee? Mr. Osberg, thank you for your presentation.
Madam Chair, I will present on behalf of Assistant Commissioner Lauren Coleman the continuing care budget pages. It's in section 4 of your book.
Yeah. Senator Sharon.
I just should say I am, in spite of the fact that you can tell that I have intense concern and complaints about how we've approached reimbursements to hospitals. I think that they're seriously flawed, and that even rebasing based on the assumptions that go into rebasing will continue to create a flawed outcome. I do want to say I really appreciate your finding the $81 million that you started your presentation with. It's that kind of examination and initiative that helps us out, and I really do appreciate that. And my concerns are not about you, but about what we're doing here with what's being proposed by the governor.
Mr. Osberg.
In section 4 is the continuing care pages. That's the section prior to the health care. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm, as I said, presenting on behalf of Assistant Commissioner Lauren Coleman, who could not be here today. And the Continuing Care Administration, like all of DHS, was asked to come up with some proposals to produce savings, program savings. And we realize that this committee needs to do the same thing, and you have the same question as to where to make reductions and where to preserve services. As you will see here in our pages, the majority of the continuing care reductions are through a 2.5% provider rate reduction and greater limits on the growth in disability waiver programs. And Madam Chair, page 1 is the first budget page I'd like to review. And this proposal recommends a 2.5% rate reduction for home and community-based waiver programs, home care services such as personal care services, as well as nursing facilities, as well as ICFMRs, and continuing care grants. And this will all be effective July 1st of 2010. Now, we're also asking for additional funding, however, to assess and monitor over time the effect of these reductions on access to long-term care services. I'll talk more about that in a minute. The 2.5% rate reduction impacts the provider groups listed on the page, with the exception of those that show a zero. You see at the page of a listing of the cuts. The previous proposals that you've heard from DHS outline the rate reductions in those other provider groups, if any at all. So you get an idea as to what areas are being cut in the 2.5% reduction. It's on the first page of the budget page. Again, when provider rate reductions are recommended, the department is often asked the question, what will result of this because of this rate cut in terms of access? For this reason, the proposal recommends funding to monitor and evaluate the status of clients' ability to access long-term care services on an ongoing basis. The department is required by federal law to ensure that there continues to be reasonable access to MA services for our clients. Although the department is not aware of any significant reduction in access to services, long-term care services, at this point, additional cuts will stress, no doubt, will stress provider networks. And so we need to monitor that. We do, as I say, also on the page two, there's some history in terms of those rate changes. That graph does not include the nursing facilities piece, but this proposal does include a nursing facility cut of 2.5%. Now, without these recommendations, long-term care spending would go up on average about 5% per year. And so that's, again, in order for us to meet our target to reduce the deficit, we are proposing a 2.5% reduction of long-term care services and payment for those services. This proposal saves $37.3 million in the general fund in this biennium and $104 million in the next biennium, as the budget page shows.
Mr. Osberg, your statement that long-term care spending is slated to increase 5%. I think it's worth noting that sometimes it's articulated that is a result of spending and policies that are out of control. And I would just argue that it is, in fact, by design in Minnesota. And we, many years ago, made a policy decision to move from statewide institutionalized settings to more home-based, to more community-based, to different delivery methods, like personal care. And so I just think that as we're looking at increased usage and growth in programs, that it's equally important that we acknowledge how it was that we got there. And it wasn't by accident, and it wasn't due to a system that's out of control. It was, in fact, by policy decisions that were made, and we are seeing the outcomes there. Mr. Osberg, you indicate that you're also asking for some additional funding. Is that reflected on this page, or is that going to appear later for us? And can you comment on the need for the agency at this time is requesting one additional FTE to monitor and evaluate the impact of future rate reductions?
Madam Chair, yes. If you look on page one, it's General Fund 85. That is the resources we're asking for per year in terms of resources necessary to monitor an ongoing basis access issue, and that FTE would be involved in making that happen.
Mr. Osberg, line 85.
GF 85. It's about the fifth line from the bottom in that graph on page one. It says contract/FTE monitoring access. It says $341,000. Per year than $262,000 per year?
Mr. Osberg, for $341,000 a year, I think I know a lot of home health
a lot of long-term care people. They can probably give us some pretty good information on the impact and the effect on access and on this budget item. And I would speculate that they might be able to provide that to us as a service for something less than $341,000. Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Osberg. Yeah, I mean, that really feels like what we're saying in broad terms here is we need to increase our administrative expenses to oversee less services. That's what it comes across to as me when I look at this page in aggregate, and I think that's not a very good message to be carrying forward.
Madam Chair and Senator
Mr. Osberg.
Lurie, that again, we're hearing concerns, obviously, from including the legislature about this very issue and as to whether or not to what extent we should can we do that to assess that impact. And so I think that this is what we're suggesting it would take for us to make that, that assessment. And we're asking that, we're suggesting that indeed we think it would be a good idea to do that. We would obviously consult many providers out there. That's what the process would be, but it's not necessarily inexpensive process.
Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the point, though, about the cost, I can understand hiring someone to track the effect of all these cuts. I mean, we need to know that. But $341,000, I mean, that's like 10 times the salary we get. I'm just wondering what kind of position or person that should be looking at
hiring. Madam Chair,
Mr.
Osberg. Erickson Ropes, can I ask Bob Meyer to address that assessment?
Mr. Meyer, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, as Director Osberg indicated, there is a Medicaid requirement that we retain access to those Medicaid-funded services that we have in our Medicaid state plan. Many of these programs are funded by Medicaid, and therefore the proposal, as you know, is a base adjustment. This last year, we reduced these rates by 2.58%. This proposal is doing an additional reduction of 2.5%. What we really feel is called for here is some additional monitoring on client access, which is the Medicaid requirement, and roughly 4,500 providers are involved here that are getting MA providers that provide long-term care services. And it's not just a matter of monitoring the providers. It is a matter of monitoring access to services. And we have providers that go in and out of business all the time in these areas. So it is a matter of monitoring the access to services that our recipients have. And those monitorings would occur geographically as well as by certain service areas.
It makes me wonder if, as we're monitoring the impact on this particular budget page, if included that in that should be the impact that the loss of GAMC is going to have on our communities, that the impact of the proposals for Minnesota Care are going to have for our community. So there certainly would be no shortage of things in terms of access and impacts that could be developed and worked on. Mr. Osberg, Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Senator Lynch. And just appreciate the explanation of the job that would be required monitoring all those providers, and that would be complicated. But I just want to make sure that I'm really understanding it. So $341,000 for one FTE?
Mr. Meyer.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator, no. Actually, FTE costs us about $100,000 a year with benefits and salary. The rest of this would be contract monies. We'd be contracting with firms that would be providing assistance, that would be doing data exploration data analysis and stuff for us, so that we could actually do a much more systematic job and provide much more systematic information about how access is being affected by these reductions.
Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So then you're saying that you're hiring a person to do the monitoring, and then you're going to contract out the monitoring to many other providers or
Mr. Meyer. Mr. Meyer.
Madam Chair, Senator, the position would be doing a variety of things, certainly overseeing the effort itself, but there are certain things that we would not be contracting for. For example, some of the data acquisition, in other words, getting access to our own systems, getting access to some of the data. So what we would be contracting for is actually the analysis of much of the information that we're being made available internally, and then much of some of the report preparation also falls back on us as well.
Mr. Osberg, please continue.
Madam Chair, members, on page 3, this proposal recommends limiting the growth of the Community Alternatives for Disabled Individuals, or CADI, waiver program to 60 new allocations per month, and the Traumatic Brain Injury, or TBI, waiver program to 6 allocations per month, effective July 1st, 2010, and through until June 2011. It also limits the growth for the developmental disability waiver to 6 diversion allocations per month, effective January 1st, 2011, until the end of that fiscal year. Now, you can see on the budget page, in the second page, in page 4, what we're referring to in terms of what the current limit looks like as relates to waiver slots, and then what the new proposed 1 year, again, an interim limit of 1 year, would look like for and the reductions. A reduction of about 400. These temporary one-year limits means an additional 100 people for the DD waiver, and approximately 400 people for the CADI waiver would have to wait for waiver services that otherwise would not have to do under current law. Although these individuals would not have access to waiver services, a vast majority will be eligible to receive services through the state plan or medical assistance state plan, home care benefit or PCA benefit, or other state funded benefits like our family support grant or consumer support grant. So there's other alternatives for people who are not able to enroll into a waiver arrangement. And this proposal saves $2 million in this biennium, $6.6 million in the next biennium.
So, Mr. Osberg, would it be a fair statement to say that there are Minnesotans that are in need of services who currently are on waiting list, and with this proposal, there will be longer waiting lists and additional Minnesotans that service needs aren't being met?
Madam Chair, there will be a longer waiting list, but again, there are other arrangements that may be available for these people to benefit from. As I said, it's the state plan home care and PCA arrangement through medical assistance, and also through family support grants or consumer support grants that we have. So there's other resources. So I'm not suggesting necessarily they're not they'll have access to services, but we think certainly that will help. Now, it's not the preference. These people would benefit probably from being in a waiver program, but at this point we need to, for financial reasons only, we need to limit number who enroll in that program for 1 year.
Mr. Osberg, please continue.
Madam Chair, members, page 5, this proposal recommends eliminating the automatic adjustment to the elderly waiver, what we call EW monthly case mix caps. That's the amount of monies available for elderly waiver services based on acuity. That's what I mean by case mix. When there is an increase in the average statewide nursing facility payment rates, in other words, when that nursing facility payment rates change, then this amount changes, and we're trying to disconnect that. If enacted, the EW case mix limits would only be adjusted when the legislature authorizes a change in home and community-based service rates. And this results in a $2.1 million savings in the general fund. So in other words, the increase would not be as great as it would have been otherwise. Those case mix rates.
Please continue, Mr. Osberg.
Madam Chair, members, of page six, this is a funding shift. This proposal recommends shifting the $2 million HIV state grant budget to capture, to the next biennium, to capture a short-term surplus in the HIV drug rebate account. We have a drug rebate account that helps us certainly manage the cost of this program. And because of recent federal regulation change, we are to expend that drug rebate money within a period of time. So we're suggesting we'll spend the drug rebate money first and then delay the expenditure for the state-funded portion of it until the next biennium. This does not mean that we reduce services at all. During fiscal year 2011, the drug rebate account would pay insurance and case management expenditures normally paid by the state appropriation. So it will still continue to do support the program as intended by the state appropriation, where we pay into insurance arrangements of people on HIV and also case management expenditures. So it's a shift to the next biennium.
Mr. Osberg, please continue.
And the last page is page eight. This proposal recommends phasing out nursing facility rate equalization over a three-year period of time. This certainly will require a great deal of discussion in the next few months. Rate equalization prohibits nursing facilities from charging private pay residents daily rates more than the medical assistance program, except for private pay residents in single rooms. Rate equalization would be gradually phased out by allowing incremental rate increases starting October of this year. October of this year, they can go as up to 2%. I'm sorry, July of this year. July of this year, I'm not sure I get this right. July of this year, it can, beginning July 1st and through the next 15 months after that, it can go up to 2% higher.
Mr. Osberg, is that what's reflected in the table on page 8? Trying to follow, I don't... July 1st date.
No, yeah, it's not wrong.
Mr.
It's wrong.
Osberg.
It's, it should be 7-1 to 9-30 for the 2%. So to change 10-1 to 7-1. The next one is correct. And the rest of them are correct. No, 14 should be 13. So 10-1 should be 10-1-13 instead of 10-1-14. And it should be 7-1-10, first line instead of 7-10-1-10.
Mr. Osberg, could you follow up with the committee after the meeting with a corrected page?
Yes,
for
we
page
will do that,
8. I think that'd be helpful.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Coring.
thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my question is so we're taking the limitation off of nursing homes that if somebody's private pay, the nursing home can charge as much as they want after a certain time period? Is that correct?
After
Mr. Osberg.
Madam Chair, Senator Coring, after October of 2013, that is correct.
Well,
Senator Coring.
I think that's stupid. I really do. Just because somebody has saved and scrimped their entire life and they go in a nursing home and they're charged more because they have saved money, and then it's just chewed up this that much faster. And then I just think that's just dumb. But that's just my opinion, of course.
Senator Lynch,
I think Mr. Osberg was very perceptive when he prefaced his comments by this item will certainly create an opportunity for a lot of discussion. You're right, Senator Coring. We'll do Senator Erickson-Ropes, and we'll go to Senator Sharon's. Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Coring, this seems to be a perfect example of cost shifting the state's responsibility for adequately funding long-term care over into the private sector. So if the state isn't stepping up and taking care of the payments to nursing homes that we should be doing. We're giving the nursing homes permission to raise the rates on private pay. So you're right. But if you keep following that line of thought, then private pay people are going to run out of their family money faster and be on state programs. So we're just creating this vicious downward spiral.
Senator Sharon.
Senator Erickson-Ropes has communicated some of what I think will have to be part of the discussion. It's clear, though, that the nursing homes have come, at least to my office, to talk about this as something that they like because they need some way of capturing all the costs that are being placed upon them as they carry much more complex cases, as we reduce hospital stays. And so what I've tried to say is that it's very hard for me to support bad policy like this, even though that because of a situation that's been created by another bad policy. So it's one bad proposal followed by a solution that's another bad proposal in terms of shifting costs. We allow the hospitals to do this. That's one of the arguments for why we should let nursing homes do this. This is where other states allow this to happen. And we need to be able to look at its implications in other states. We already know the problems that have occurred in hospitals because we allow a differential in payment. And so the hospitals can make up their losses by passing these costs off to others. And it's really a policy decision that we make about how we collect revenue, how we pay for things. Do we narrow it to a few people, or do we come back and say, hey, maybe we need to support these kinds of essential responsibilities of government from the general fund and through general revenue sources?
I would just say that
Senator Klein.
Thank you. I would just say that I almost feel like we're sliding into a class warfare between some people that happen to have money and then the people that don't have money. And I had some people that come into my office and said, let's tax the rich. No, that's going to fix all our problems. But I know some people who are farmers who have milk cows and they've worked hard all their life and they might have $400,000. And you might think, that's a lot of money. The interest would not pay off of that $400,000 would not pay for their private pay nursing home, and so that money will just be chewed right up. And I just think that's and it'll be chewed up that much quicker. I don't mind if it's exactly the same as the public programs pay, but I don't know why we're penalizing somebody just because they've got some money to pay for the program. But you know what? Whatever. It's
Madam Chair.
Mr. Osberg.
Let me address the point that Senator Erickson-Ropes made in terms of the budget effect. In terms of the near-term budget horizon, this biennium, the next biennium, we don't think there will be a budget effect, but eventually there will be. You're probably right. But at this point, our assessment is that this is budget neutral for this the current budget horizon, but at some point, the issue of a medical spend down will be there. Madam Chair, that completes our budget pages.
Thank you, Mr. Osberg.
All right. I guess we're going to move on then, and we'll hear from the Department of Veterans Affairs. Deputy Commissioner.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Deputy Commissioner Gilbert Acevedo for the Minnesota Department of Veteran Affairs.
We We have a page that's been handed out to us, so we can find a way to put it in our book later.
Yes, ma'am. Good morning. I've been asked to present the governor's 2010 supplemental budget recommendations for the department. There are two. First one is the Fergus Falls expansion operations of the veterans' home there. This proposal funds a operational increase for a 21-bed addition to the Fergus Falls Veterans Home approved in the 2008 bonding bill. During the, in 2009, we were notified by the United States Department of Veteran Affairs that under the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, funds were made available for the nursing homes or state veterans homes construction project, and the Fergus Falls 21-bed project was approved at that point. We received the funding approval for that, and so we're requesting the operational funds for that 21-bed.
And is your department taking any reductions to help fund this request?
Madam Chair, no.
So then our committee is left in a position of cutting other nursing homes in order to fund this one?
Madam Chair, when the proposal was submitted, actually there's a history here. It was originally proposed by the Veterans Home Board for the 2005-2006 bonding, which was not picked up by the governor nor the legislature. It was again resubmitted in 2007-2008 by the Veterans Home Board, which at that time, the Veterans Home Board was abolished, and there was a merger with the Department of Veteran Affairs. So the department carried the bonding request for the Veterans Home Board. That year for bonding, it was not picked up by the governor, but was picked up by the legislature, two legislators from the Fergus Falls area. That was presented through the bonding committee. The bonding committee accepted it, approved it, and part of the fiscal or the budget pages with that also explained that there would be operational costs tied to that.
I understand all of that. What I don't understand is where we get the money, since we don't have any. And there are veterans in nursing homes all over the state. You're not just taken care of in the nursing homes that are run by your department.
Madam Chair, I understand that.
And what happens if this funding request is not met?
Based on CFR, 38 CFR, the United States Department of Veteran Affairs will request the state to pay back the funds that was appropriated to build. So the 65%, which is $6.3 million would be required to be paid back to the federal government.
What if the funding request is delayed?
There is a process. We could certainly ask the federal government to delay that. But once the project is complete, we have to go through a certification process with the United States Department of Veteran Affairs. Once that's done, that approves the VA per diem. And then at that point, we have to start operating. So there is a timeline, which I can get the exact timeline. I was under the impression we were going to testify on Tuesday, so I was trying to get that exact timeline from the federal government, but I can get that to you.
I appreciate that. Are there other questions on this item? Senator Cornyn.
Madam Chair and Assistant Commissioner, I think I know the answer to this question is... the 65% is how much?
Madam Chair, Senator Coring, 6.3. Million.
6.3.
It's the construction dollars.
Right. Can I ask another question?
You may.
When that, the state of Minnesota bonded for that money, and then we get reimbursed that money. We don't?
I apologize for shaking my head, Madam Chair, Senator Coring. There are two ways that that can be done. The way you're describing is one way, but this project was not done that way. This project was requesting a bonding for the 35%, at which time the project would be put on a list. Then once the 65% would be made available is when we would receive the funding. So there is not a reimbursement. This is money that was appropriated to the state.
Okay. And where I was, Madam Chair, and where I was going with this is sometimes we do that, and then when we get the reimbursement from the federal government, that actually goes into general fund. Am I correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Coring, that's partially correct. It depends on how the legislation is written. Mm-hmm. If it's not clear, it goes back to the general fund. If it's written that it would go back to pay off the bonds, it could be done that way as well.
Okay. So how was this written for this particular project?
Madam Chair, since there is no reimbursement, it's going directly towards funding the construction of the project.
Any other questions about this item?
I thought maybe I could find a rock and see
Senator
that.
Coring, I'm so glad you're helping. I need all the help I can get.
I thought maybe if we were getting that money back and it was going to the general fund, then we could maybe use it, but I guess not. So, sorry. I'll keep
you
looking.
You keep looking. You do that. Any other questions on this item?
Madam Chair, how much of this is how much of this is carried on our books?
Just the nursing home items, the first two.
Just the first two. That's what I thought. Thank you.
Any other questions on the Fergus Falls item? Okay, let's go on to the next one then.
Yes, Madam Chair. Second item is the Minneapolis Adult Daycare operation. That request is $475,000, a one-time startup cost. The proposal for the funds, as I mentioned, a one-time startup for operational expense related to the Minneapolis Veterans Home Adult Daycare operation. Construction for or renovation for this project will be completed around April of 2011. And this was as a result of authorization from the legislative bonding approval in 2005.
And my recollection of that was that there was no indication there would be an operating expense as related to this project.
Madam Chair, that's correct. We would need startup just so we can hire the staff, but after that it would be self-sufficient through self-sustaining through either the VA per diem and, of course, the whatever fees are required that we would charge those residents.
So would it be possible that this could be paid back later in the biennium?
I would have to go back and look at the numbers, but it's possible.
I'd appreciate that.
Yes, ma'am. Are
there any other questions about this item? No, thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Actually, I have a question if I can ask the Assistant Commissioner. Sure. Not on this item, but this is kind of, and I probably shouldn't be worrying about this, but I'm just worrying about the future. Right now we're putting together the, you know, we're deciding on what's going to be in the bonding bill, and there's another proposal for Wilmer that I'm sure you're aware of. If that happens to survive through the bonding process, we'll have to come up with operating expenses in this committee. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Coring, that is correct. And as
that's not a proposal that you're bringing forward, but could you tell us how much the annual operating costs would be?
I apologize, ma'am. We don't have that today, but we can get you that information.
And when those operating costs would begin.
Yes, ma'am.
Any other questions? Thank you again.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Kristen Dybel, this is the last tab in your book under other agencies because this is really a budget page that's in the State Department's budget, but seems as if it might have a big impact on the Department of Human Services, and so we'd like to understand what that impact might be better.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Kristen Dibdahl with Minnesota Management and Budget. There is an additional $9 million reduction in the governor's budget proposal. It's an ongoing reduction, and it's meant to reduce state agency operating budgets. This proposal is essentially a two-part proposal. The first step is that Minnesota Management and Budget, the Department of Administration, and OET will be meeting, and they've started to meet already, to discuss some enterprise-wide strategies for reducing costs. And this would include things like consolidating IT functions, looking at professional technical contract reductions, utilizing space more efficiently. So they are meeting to discuss these types of initiatives that could have the effect of reducing agency operating budgets in general over the next few weeks. The second part would be, to the extent that the $9 million cannot be realized through those types of initiatives, MMB would then do an allocated across-the-board reduction on state agencies.
So how much do you realistically believe of this $9 million will be accomplished through the Office of Enterprise Technology?
Madam Chair, I don't have a projection on that. That's what folks are looking at right now to figure out.
Well, how did you pick the $9 million number?
Madam Chair, that was the additional 3% reduction figure.
So it was just a number somebody needed to fill out the rest of the incomplete budget we've received from the governor so far?
Madam Chair, I know that there was some thought around, you know, most of the targets for agencies on grants were around 6%. And so it was thought that making an equivalent reduction on operating budgets was appropriate.
But this isn't a straight operating budget reduction. This is like a number, and we'll figure it out later.
Madam Chair.
Senator Laurie.
It's under the umbrella of non-operating, in fact, when you look at the sheet up at the top. I mean, it's called an operating budget reduction under the general heading of non-operating costs. I'm confused by that.
Madam Chair, I think what, or Senator Laurie, what you're referring to is just an account that MMB uses to, we had to put it somewhere, and that's where we chose to place it technically in the budget, but it is meant to reduce state agency operating budgets.
So if you're not able to realize these savings through the Office of Enterprise Technology, what part of this reduction would go to the Department of Human Services and what part would go to the Department of Health?
Madam Chair, the methodology for allocating the remaining savings has yet to be determined, as you noted. Usually, if it's an across the board, it would be that percentage would be determined and then allocated based on DHS's operating budget, for example, or the health department's operating budget.
So you're going to be asking us to vote on something that hasn't been determined?
Madam Chair, I can only report what I know about the initiative and how far along it is. So,
well, I just have to say I don't think it's appropriate for us to be making decisions about these two departments' budgets without understanding what the impact of this piece would be. And I certainly must say, based on what you've just told me today, I don't understand.
Madam Chair, I'm hoping that within the next few weeks, there will be some more communication with the legislature on how much of the savings can be realized with the first step, the enterprise-wide initiatives, and that you can receive some information on that.
So when do you think we should ask you to come back? We
Madam
don't want to
Chair,
waste our time or yours.
I'll be in communication with your staff, but I'm thinking in the next few weeks.
All right. Any other questions? No, thank you. And that completes our agenda today. Thank you very much, members. We will be taking testimony on the governor's budget next week, at least on Tuesday and Wednesday.